From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There is a report that Presidential Candidates Forum is all but dead. We're talking about the Unity Convention, the biggest journalism convention in America. And with us, we have Richard Prince of Journalism from the Maydern Institute. Richard, how are you?
Hi, Farai. Good to talk with you.
Well, tell us a little bit about the importance of Unity, first of all, and about this conference.
Well, the Unity Conference is the Unity Group is a coalition of the Journalist of Color organizations, the National Association of Black Journalists, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Asian American Journalists Association, and the Native American Journalists Association. And it is, as you said, the largest assemblage of journalists of color in the country and possibly the world. We're not sure about that. But in any case, they've been doing this since 1994. They did it every 5 years. They rescheduled it every 4 years to take advantage of the presidential election years.
Richard, let me ask you just to cut in a little bit.
Sure.
About the importance of this conference. I mean, 4 years ago, you had a huge amount of political participation in terms of people who came who were candidates or, of course, the sitting president. What's the importance of this convention politically? What has it been in terms of journalists?
Well, last year, both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton were at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention. At that time, the talk in all the media was, is Obama black enough? This was an occasion, and he used the occasion to address that issue and say, and he said, enough already. You know, I'm definitely black enough. After that, he went and talked with the Trotter Group, which is a group of African-American columnists. And at that meeting, we saw a more nuanced version of Obama who had a black perspective on world events and on national events. You can't underestimate the importance of being able to reach journalists who are spreading the message, as perhaps this week's flap over the New Yorker illustrates.
Now, we spoke with Unity President Karen Lincoln Michelle. She said that this report was, quote, inaccurate, and she said she was unable to confirm their attendance, said that Obama would release a schedule in the next 24 hours, which would clarify his attendance. What do you make of that?
Well, all I know is that the press secretary for the German prime minister announced today that Obama will be meeting with Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, that same day. So it could be that maybe they're trying to get Obama to come some other day, but it's not going to be that day. And McCain, of course, is scheduled to be in Columbus, Ohio, at the Lance Armstrong's Live Strong, a town hall meeting and event for cancer research.
If your report is correct, what does it say, if anything, about the influence of this group? And what I mean specifically is that we have seen just this week both candidates speak to the NAACP. And what makes Unity different is that it really is this conglomeration of the Black, Latino, Asian American, and Native American journalist groups. But does it kind of mean that the diversity moment is over, that there's just not enough room for two in 10 days?
No, I'm not sure about that. Both candidates also have sought Latino votes by going to Latino organizations. And every time I would ask the McCain campaign about attending Unity, they would always say, well, you know, he's going to the Urban League and the NAACP. So that's the way they look at it. They're not really looking at this as journalists, I don't think, as, you know, which interest groups can I check off, which box should I check off for various interest groups. And McCain has checked off his black box, and so therefore didn't feel the need, and the Latino box with the Latinos, to attend Unity.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Farai. Good to be here.
That was journalist and columnist Richard Prince of the Maydern Institute, and we're going to continue our roundtable with a couple more folks, Bruce Dixon, managing editor of the online news journal BlackAgendaReport.com, and Deidre Childress, editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine. Welcome, guys.
How you doing?
Welcome.
So, Deidre, I understand that you also have a role at the NABJ. What's that?
I am the national secretary for the Association of Black Journalists. And Obama was, as Richard mentioned, he did come to our convention last year. We had an opportunity to hear him up close, very personal in a great setting. And it's disappointing that he is not likely to be at our convention this Thursday. But as Karen Lincoln-Michaels said, there are some negotiations continuing. I think there'll be a news release in the next 24 hours with his intentions towards the alliance partners. And I think this could still have a positive outcome. I'm very hopeful about it because he has been good to our organization in the past. I think one of the reasons that he may have to do what he's doing next week is he really has to look at his appearance in front of American voters in terms of foreign policy. If you look at the New York Times today, each morning he has a cast of 300 advisors talking to him about foreign policy, despite the fact that he's a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So I think that trip has probably taken precedence over us.
I assume you're going to be at the convention?
Definitely. I'm going to be there from Monday through next Sunday, and we are still hoping to hear from him, as well as Senator McCain, and I think there'll be an announcement tomorrow.
All right. Bruce, are you going?
Don't think so. I've got a project in North Carolina and in Atlanta here that's going to be keeping me busy right then.
What do you think, if the candidates are not able to make an appearance, is that a bad thing?
Well, the number one rule if you're a presidential candidate is that you do not want unrestricted questions coming to you. You just don't want that. So that's not a good thing. If you can't control the audience and you can't control the questions, candidates just don't like that stuff. Number two, it's kind of the wrong question to ask, what does this say about the influence of unity that the presidential candidates won't come and speak before you, because journalists don't get their legitimacy from the willingness of candidates or powerful people to talk to them. That's kind of the wrong way to go on that. That journalists get their legitimacy by telling the truth, whether the candidates or the office holders like it or not.
Bruce, I want to move on to another topic. Nelson Mandela today celebrates his 90th birthday after a series of public celebrations. He is spending the day in his home in rural South Africa. And in an interview at his home, Mandela was asked if he had a message for the world. Let's listen to what he said.
Many people in South Africa who are rich, who can share those riches with people who are not so fortunate, who have not been able to conquer poverty. If you look around, even in towns, not only the countryside, even in towns, there's a lot of poverty.
Bruce, this is a man who spent decades in prison, came out, was on the terrorist watch list until recently, or the terrorism list in the United States. He's lived so many lives. What do you think he's done with his post-presidency period?
Well, he's done about the best you can do with his post-presidency period. He went to jail as head of a movement and emerged as head of a nation. He got into office and got out with his reputation pretty much intact. And he cut the best deal, I guess, that he thought he could. But there's still, just like he says, a lot of poverty and a lot of want in South Africa. Miriam Makeba, I think, said it best right before the first South African election. She said that they gave us the flag, but they got to keep the money. And that's basically what you see in South Africa now. South Africa is under the same kind of neoliberal regime that much of the rest of Africa is in. And the poor being squeezed by privatizations of water and electricity, and they're being driven deeper into debt. Wages are going down, and it's just a sad, sad situation. It's much, much better than the apartheid era, but there's still a whole lot to go. There's still a long, long road, like Mandela says, and a lot to do.
Deirdre, I want to move on to our final topic. Barack Obama is gearing up for a trip to Iraq, the Middle East, and Europe. It'll be his first as the presumptive Democratic nominee. And with the top three nightly news anchors, they're all going. Katie Couric, Brian Williams, and Charlie Gibson. Some 200 journalists are vying for other spots. And, you know, there hasn't been the same love from journalists for McCain. He toured Iraq back in March, met with Iraqi and U.S. military officials, but he was not accompanied by any of these top network anchors. Is that a double standard?
I think there has been a little bit in this area, because it just seems like when you look at the reports across the nation, anything that Barack does related to the Muslim world, Islamic communities, seems to get far more attention than the attention that we've been giving to Senator McCain in this area. And I think it's important for him to go. I think it's important for him to do. And in some ways, maybe this is about answering a question a lot of voters have about him in terms of his foreign policy experience when it's stacked up against Senator McCain.
Bruce, some conservatives are irked by this. Some are accusing the media of acting like groupies following a rock star on a world tour. Is there any truth to that?
Well, we'll see. I mean, he hasn't landed in Iraq yet, so we don't know exactly what the coverage of him in Iraq is going to look like. There is a kind of convergence of interest, though, between the Obama campaign and the mainstream media, because the mainstream media haven't been reporting much about the Iraq conflict at all. It's dwindled to a backstory or no story at all. And Obama faces a little bit of danger there, because many of his constituents think that he's the candidate who wants to end the war. And they may find out differently once he goes over there that, so it's the whole moment is fraught with danger for Mr. Obama. And it's problematic for the media anyway, just because they don't really want to cover the war.
Deirdre, very quickly, what should we as journalists do in terms of parity between the two candidates? Do we deserve to give them equal time?
I think we need to really focus on that. I'm thinking about the New Yorker cover that came out this week, and people were saying, well, why don't we have a New Yorker cover, satire with some satire about Senator McCain? I think it's up to us to try to work within our standards as journalists, to try to keep things fair, equal, and to constantly seek the truth.
All right. On that note, thank you both.
Thank you.
Deirdre Childress is editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Weekend Magazine and joined us from the Audio Post studios in Philadelphia. And Bruce Dixon is the managing editor of BlackAgendaReport.com and joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Dizzy Gillespie is considered to be the first musician to fuse jazz with Afro-Cuban and Latin rhythms. More than five decades later, Latin jazz is more popular than ever, and the genre is constantly evolving. As we continue our month-long series on jazz, we bring you a look at Latin jazz. With us, Jose Rizzo. He's the music director for the Southern California radio station KKJZ. He hosts the show Jazz on the Latin Side. He's also the band leader of the 15-piece big band, the Jazz on the Latin Side All-Stars. We're also joined by band leader and percussionist Pancho Sanchez. He's released more than 23 albums, including his latest, Raise Your Hand. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jose, let me start with you. How did Latin jazz come to be?
Well, it started back in the 40s, in the mid-40s. And if there's a seed for Latin jazz, I would have to say it would be Mario Bauza, because he brought in the jazz harmonies into Machito's Latin band. And then later he was also very close with Dizzy Gillespie, and he was more of a mentor for Dizzy. And when Dizzy saw what his mentor was doing with the Latin jazz stuff, Dizzy wanted something like that in his band as well.
I mean, we're going to get to a whole bunch of music. And I just want to say that we have so much music that we've queued up. I'm going to go in order of what we have, but we're not going to get to.
No, there's no way.
We're not going to get to hardly anything. Let's start with Tito Puente. Let's first take a listen. Pancho, I think that most people will know that song, whether or not they know a lot about Tito Puente. I was so pleased to be able to see him at an arts festival. What's his significance in this genre?
Well, Tito
was a very good friend of mine. As a matter of fact, my son that's standing outside in the hallway there, his name is Tito. I named him after Tito Puente. That's how close I was with Tito. Tito was guest with my band many times. I was guest with his band many times. And Tito plays a great role in the Latin music scene and also the Latin jazz scene. The thing about this tune we just heard a clip of, a piece of, is Oye Como Va. I remember when a friend came to my home when I was in high school, and they brought me the Santana recording of Oye Como Va. He said, there's a new song out called Oye Como Va by Carlos Santana. And he put it on for me, and I said, so you think that's new, huh? And I took out one of my old records, and I put the original Tito Puente. I says, that song was recorded 14 years before that. And he goes, oh, that guy copied Santana, huh? I said,
no.
The other way around.
Now, go ahead.
Yeah, and Tito, you know, he didn't like that version of Oye Como Va. He told me the story, too. And then one day he opened his mailbox and he got this check in the mail.
That's right.
And he looked at it and Tito goes, my favorite version of Oye Como Va from Carlos Santana.
Yeah.
That's right.
Gotta love those royalties.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pancho, tell me about some of the other artists who influenced your music early in your career.
Well, for me, we started at the beginning with Dizzy Gillespie and Chano Poza. Mario Bowser introduced them together, and Jose touched upon that. Of course, the great Mongo Santa Maria, who I named my other son after. I have a son also named Mongo. And Mongo was a very good friend of mine and also was a guest many times with my band and vice versa. And Mongo's on one of my CDs entitled Conga Blue that we dedicated to Mongo. Mongo played with us on it. So I would say the great Mongo Santa Maria, conga drummer, and of course the late great Cal Jader, who I spent 7.5 years with touring the world, and I won a Grammy with Cal Jader in 1980.
Let's listen to a little bit of him. Jose, when you choose what to play, how do you choose what to play, given the variety of what we've already heard?
Well, when I first started doing radio on K-Jazz, it was almost 20 years ago, and Latin jazz was still not something that people would pin down, like, this is what Latin jazz is. So I did a lot of searching, a lot of exploring, and I just kind of discovered this range that I kind of tap into, you know, from head-on jazz musicians. In fact, I discovered a lot of music that straight-ahead jazz musicians were doing that they didn't realize they were doing, as far as that could fit under the Latin jazz category, Sonny Rollins and Eddie Lockjaw Davis. So I really got deep into what the great jazz musicians were already doing.
One of the things we talk about on our show is ethnicity, whether it's African ethnicity, the ethnicity of immigrants into the African-American culture, Latino ethnicity. And, of course, there are people from so many parts of the world who may be who may put themselves under the umbrella of Latino. Where do you think this music comes from in terms of the influences of region that end up in this?
Well, in every region, the music is expressed in different ways, you know. And I think now it's beyond really cultures and ethnicity. I mean, the fact that Dizzy Gillespie was one of the creators of this music, and Cal Jader was one of the proponents that really influenced so many people into listening to Latin jazz, and none of them are Latino, you know.
That's right. Cal was a Swedish descent, you know, and Jose is absolutely correct. Nowadays, there's so many different types of people that are involved in Latin jazz now. But one thing I'm very, very proud of is that Latin jazz is mine and yours. If you were born in the United States of America, this is our music. This is American music. Latin jazz was born in New York City by the great Dizzy Gillespie, the great jazz trumpet player, and when he met the great Cuban conga drummer, dancer, and composer, Chano Poza, when they met in about 1945 or something like that, that's when they met. That's when Latin jazz came alive, right here in the United States of America. So I'm proud to say it's ours. You know?
It is our music. And Dizzy Gillespie, you know, being so fond of Mario Bauza, his mentor, he would go see the Machito Orchestra.
That's
and
right.
Dizzy would say, hey, Mario, can you give me one of those tom-tom players?
Yeah, he called him a tom-tom
player. He didn't know what to call him, so he called him a tom-tom player. Can I get a tom-tom player?
Instead of a conga drummer, you know? A tom-tom is like a drum. You know?
Right, right. Totally different.
And Mario Bausa brought Chano Pozo, and that's when it started on the jazz end.
That's right.
Well, in case you are just joining us midway, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. This is part of our month-long series on jazz, and we're talking today about Latin jazz with Jose Rizzo, music director for the Southern California radio station KKJZ. He also hosts their show Jazz on the Latin Side, plus band leader and percussionist Pancho Sanchez. And Pancho, you've got a CD, Out of Sight. It's a tribute to one of your heroes, James Brown. Ray Charles and Billy Preston sing One Mint Julep on the CD. You put a Latin twist on the song. Let's take a listen. Well, this is actually, you know, always radio is an art form, and we actually play the wrong song. So first of all, tell us what we're listening to.
That tune's called Saints and Sinners, written by David Torres, my musical director in the band. And that's David playing organ and piano on there. Saints and Sinners, but it's cool. That's pretty close.
At least it's yours.
Yeah, that's right.
They were in the studio together.
Yeah, that's right. They're together, you know what I mean? But One Mint Julep is a tune that, of course, was made very popular in the 60s by Ray Charles himself and Ray's on here and the great Billy Preston on organ.
Well, you know what? We have the song now. Let's hear it. So what do you like about that song? And obviously, you know, you must like it, but specifically, what do you like about that song, its rhythms, et cetera?
Well, you know, that tune, when I was a kid, I would hear Ray Charles, I would hear that on the radio, on the record player, and I always loved that tune because it was very happy, you know, and it's got a good groove. And Ray did it as a cha-cha, but I don't think he really knew he was doing it exactly like a cha-cha-cha, you know, because his was a little different. And I said, man, that lends itself perfectly to the cha-cha-cha rhythm, you know? And, of course, the cha-cha-cha is a dance and a rhythm. And so, and it's got the blues feel to
right.
it.
All
and
the elements.
All that stuff together. I mean, to me, that is Latin jazz, and that is our American music. And then Billy Preston, who they call the fifth Beatle, Billy came in to play the organ on that with us. And then Ray overdubbed his voice in the center. You could hear Ray in the center here talking with us. And he also recorded another song with us, Marianne.
And that's something that Poncho has brought to the world of Latin jazz, that R&B influence. Willie Bobo and Mongo did it a little bit back in the 60s and 70s. And Poncho just took on a whole new personality in combining those elements. In fact, he even took the New Orleans sound with the harmonica and all that and the singing and brought Latin jazz and, you know, kind of fused it with Latin jazz. So he's having a good time, putting his own voice, his own stamp on Latin jazz.
It's clear that both of you are having a good time. And Jose, a little bit later, we're going to hear some of your work. But, you know, in addition to this being an American music, you've talked a little bit so far about how it's popular in Europe and you know, I hope I get his name right. Sebastian Schunke.
Yeah,
Schunke. Let's hear a little bit of him. Now, what do you like about this music, and what do you hear when you hear it?
Well, Sebastian Schunke added also a classical element to Latin jazz, and there's some parts where he goes off more into a classical direction, and it's more like orchestral, and he puts a lot of elements, a lot of progressive jazz that's used in it. And a lot of European players and people in South America, they're listening to the Latin jazz from the U.S., but they're as well adding their own special elements of their region, of their culture, and creating just something new, just the music evolving.
Pancho, when you look out in the audience, I'm sure you see a lot of different types of audiences, but what's your connection with the audience when you play?
Well, it's just the music itself that we play, the feel that you get from the music. You know, we just were in Europe. We were in Istanbul, Turkey. We were in Finland. And, you know, we tour every couple of years to Europe and Japan and like that. And, of course, a lot of people don't even understand what we're saying. You know, they don't speak English or they don't speak Spanish, because we also sing salsa music in Spanish. But they feel the music, and so that's what the connection is. And, you know, it doesn't take but one or two songs. And in a concert, people usually start dancing, and they'll get in a corner in the aisles and start dancing. So it's just the feel, the warmth of the music and the feel of the music.
You know, in doing this series, there's we've talked a little bit about jazz radio and how jazz radio can sometimes be difficult to find for listeners. What's your sense of the state of jazz radio?
Jazz radio, for some reason, always has had a very selective audience. It just always has been that way. And jazz stations have always just tried to just survive. There are no more commercial jazz stations. Those are gone. Yeah, they're dinosaurs. But now there are the jazz survived in public radio. And now there are only less than a handful of full-time jazz stations in the whole country.
Yeah.
And so that's why the few that are left are really supported very heavily by its members, like here, K-Jazz here, and WBGO in New York City, yeah. Well, in New Jersey, in the New York area. So it's something that, and then the interesting thing about us here on the West Coast, we're trying different things. We have now Latin jazz during drive time every day, mm-hmm. 5 to 7 p.m. on K-Jazz, and that's one of the highest rated programs on the jazz station. One of the few jazz stations left in the country, probably one of the two top in the whole country, and people love listening to Latin jazz during drive time. So, you know, again, jazz radio is also evolving.
You know, the only other station also I could think in Denver, Colorado,
right.
There's a station there, Cubo. They were doing Latin jazz every third song. But actually, I think they've changed that policy now. But it is a jazz station, and Carlos Lando, our good friend there, runs the stations over there.
You know, one of the things that strikes us is that there's a question of jazz education. Do you think that there needs to be a little bit more of an outreach to people to educate them? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, for me, I've done what I do when I play universities and colleges and schools all over the country, is they usually line up clinics that we do before we play the concert. So I've done many question and answer periods and clinics with my group. I also have a book, How to Learn to Play the Basic Fundamentals of Latin Music, Poncho Sanchez book, and instructional DVD. So, yeah, of course, and then there's a lot of stuff on the internet nowadays, but very important to get more into the universities and the colleges of our music here.
I want to play a little bit of Sexto Sentido. It's a bit of your music, Jose.
Yes, four young ladies from Cuba, more going in the direction of the band Take Six, a four-way, beautifully harmonic vocal group.
So why did you decide to work on something with this feel?
Because there's jazz in there. There's jazz harmonies. And I mean, it's like listening to Take Six, but it's in Spanish, you know? And I thought it's good to expand jazz radio even further by introducing this to you know, our jazz audience. And they've been responding pretty well. And this group is very excited in Cuba. They found out we're playing their music. They even send us an ID. You know, singing about the station and my radio program, Jazz on the Latin Side. So we're making connections.
Well, we have packed in an awful lot in a short amount of time. I want to thank you both so much for your time. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
We've been speaking with Grammy Award-winning percussionist and band leader Poncho Sanchez. His latest album is Raise Your Hand, and Jose Rizzo, music director for Southern California radio station KKJZ. He also hosts their show Jazz on the Latin Side. Both were with me at our NPR West studios. You can watch video of this interview on our blog. Just go to nprnewsandviews.org. And finally, we leave you with a song from Jose's band, Jazz on the Latin Side All-Stars. The group group CD is called Tambolero. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Reverend Martin Luther King's children are suing each other over the family estate. This year's Emmy nominees are lacking in color, and Italian Vogue is breaking fashion barriers with its black issue. Here to get us up to speed is our favorite entertainment guru, Allison Samuels of Newsweek magazine. Hey, Allison.
Hi, how you doing?
I am doing great. So the children of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King are publicly feuding. Dexter King says he split the family estate with his brother, Martin Luther King III, and his sister Bernice King, but they say he's keeping a bigger piece of the pie. Now, you went to Atlanta, mm-hmm. and you were reporting for Newsweek. What were you doing?
Just trying to find out some of the deeper issues that have gone on, because that family's had issues for a while, because Dexter was the head of the Martin Luther King Foundation, and they had him removed. And this was years ago, before Coretta died, before, the older sister died. So this is not something new. I was trying to get the deeper issues on how they feel. They sort of feel like Dexter was the favorite son, and that he had more access to the money and to the financial papers of both the mother and the father. So they feel as though they've been cheated. And Dexter lives out here in Malibu, you know, a long way from them. They don't have as much contact. And I think they waited until the older sister died, Yolanda. I think she wouldn't have been very happy about this type of public sort of feud. So it's a very tangled weave. I'm going to have to go down again and really get more information, because it's really, it's a complex story. It's not something you can sort of do in, you know, a couple of days. It really does go on for years. It has been going on for years. It just sort of culminated with this actually lawsuit.
Do you have any sense of whether or not people who were of the King's generation, I'm talking about Coretta mm-hmm. and Martin Jr., are looking at this with, you know, eyes wide open or disgust or panic or any emotion?
People like Andy Young, I think, are just very disappointed, you know, that is happening, that it is happening on such a public scale, that they couldn't have resolved this, you know, one-on-one. You know, being brothers and sisters, being that the mother and the sister just died, that he feels as though they're still grieving, which I think they are. And, you know, to sort of make such a, you know, big decision to sue your other, you know, family member, you know, I think it's really embarrassing to some of the people in the civil rights movement. They sort of feel like, you know, this family should be unified, particularly this time when they've had major losses over the last couple of years. But, you know, money does things to people, loved ones included.
Well, we look forward to seeing and reading more of your reporting. Now, let's talk about the Emmys. The mm-hmm. awards were announced this week. The new AMC drama series, Mad Men, about the New York advertising industry of the early 60s, led the pack with 16 nominations. That is, the nominations were announced. But like the halls of that fictional advertising firm, the Emmy nominations seem to be lacking in people of color. What's going on?
Well, as usual, African Americans have never really been big. I mean, you've had, like, you know, the Grey's Anatomy, where you've had people like that sort of win. And I think, again, the African American actress from Grey's Anatomy is nominated this year as well. But, I think the Emmys have just been notoriously not great for us, in terms of we're not on TV as much. There are not a lot of shows that feature us. And it's going to get even worse next season, because Gary Jordan is off of CSI. Mekhi Phifer is leaving ER. So I think, you know, this is probably as good as it's going to get with this one nomination, because next year is going to be even sort of less, you know, sort of visible faces of African Americans on TV. And that's an issue we've been going through for years. Why we're still talking about it, you know, it's very disappointing and frustrating.
Are there any black actors or actresses that you think should have been nominated but weren't?
I love the show. I loved Girlfriends. I love The Game. I guess I get frustrated that they don't even get nominated. It seems like they're not even on the radar when it comes to sitcoms for the Emmys. And I think that's something that's frustrating to me, because I think Girlfriends was a really good show, and it never got even, you know, a nod the entire time it was on. It's almost the longest running comedy African-American sitcom on TV, next to Cosby. And I just think it never got that respect. So even if we're there, I'm not sure that the attention is sort of given to us. I don't even know if they watch the CW, you know, and I think that's, you know, to our disadvantage.
Well, let's talk about a completely different question, which is what categories there are. Back in 2003, the Emmys added the Outstanding Reality Competition Program. Mm-hmm. This year, there's a new category, Best Reality TV Host. What do you make of adding yet another category, particularly in reality TV?
Well, they have to acknowledge it because it's such a big market and it's such a huge moneymaker for the television industry. I guess they really couldn't avoid not acknowledging that aspect of it. I'm not a big reality TV fan, so it's hard for me to sort of really look at that. But I understand from their standpoint, when something's bringing in that kind of money, when the public is so, sort of big on reality TV, how do you not acknowledge it? But again, it's easy for them not to acknowledge African-Americans. So it's very interesting how that works that, but again, it's all about money. It's like that brings in money. So that's a category.
Well, we talked a little bit about this Italian Vogue that mm-hmm. features all black models, and right. it came at a time when really people were talking about where are the black people on the runway in the fashion right. industry. Give us an update on how that's been doing.
It's been doing great. I mean, it's sold out pretty much all over the country. They're having to do, I think this is their third reprint of it, because they most of the newsstands that I know usually get like 10 copies, but because of the demand, they were getting 100 to 200 copies, and they were selling out. On Facebook, they had this big petition saying, let's make it the biggest selling Vogue ever. And, they had a lot, thousands of signatures on that. And I think people sort of took it to heart. But I still agree with Beth Ann Hardison, who said, we love the fact that this is done, but what we want is inclusion. We don't want our separate issue. We want to be a part of regular Vogue. But I think it is a very good message to Vogue that, look, people are interested in black models. People will buy those issues. You always hear, oh, black models don't sell or black faces don't sell. And it's like, obviously that's not the case. The interesting part about this Italian Vogue, though, is all the ads are white. So it's very jarring when you look at all the black models and then all the ads are white. So it still gives you that story of, we're not getting this part of the thing. We can get in the magazine doing fashion, but we're not sort of being invested in from a commercial standpoint.
Well, Allison, great to talk to you. Thanks so much. Allison Samuels is an award-winning national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She joined us from our NPR studios in Culver City. That's music from Shantae Moore's Love the Woman. It's her first solo CD in 8 years. She's been singing duets with her husband, Kenny Lattimore, and she's been focusing on gospel music. As Shantae will tell you, the church is in her blood. And that's the first thing NPR's Tony Cox asked her. How does she straddle the two worlds, religious and secular?
Because it's not two worlds to me, I don't even think about it like that. Keeping my integrity is what I think about it. You just do your job and you do it well and you keep your integrity. And I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my children. I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my pastor. People fall in love whether you're, at the church or if you're in the club. You do fall in love the same way, the feelings, emotions, the things that it brings from the inside of who you are, it's the same. And I want to be sure that I sing about love and not sex.
Well, let me talk about that with you for a moment, because mm-hmm. that's a really fine line, isn't it?
It is, in that I think people blur the lines of what's okay to say. I believe the line is very clear.
Really?
It's very clear.
Even in your CD, this new one that you have, which mm-hmm. is Love the Woman, and the photograph of you on the cover, which is very lovely, but it suggests to me, and I'm not a Bible thumping person at all, but mm-hmm. it would suggest to me that there are some churches in America where that picture of you on the cover would yeah. be trouble.
Well, I wouldn't wear that to church. That is true. But that really is the bigger struggle for me than anything, is really? What I wear.
Really?
Absolutely. What I sing is easy.
Why is that?
You can sing about love all day long, have a really pretty voice, and have a sexy, quote-unquote sexy voice, but not sing about sex and still emote those kind of feelings. But if you don't get to see something, it's different. I don't know what it is exactly, but I've been more pressured to wear sexy things than I have to sing about sexy things.
You comfortable with this?
I am. I'm sure some people aren't, but that's the other thing I have to know is what is okay for me. Because there are some people who cannot sing R&B music because the Lord told them not to. I know that God put me in this place to stand for Him in this arena.
Do you feel what I feel when you kiss me?
In listening to this, and I've listened to it several times, let me put it this way. When you listen to the whole thing, mm-hmm. how does it feel to you?
Well, it's one of my favorite things to do is to listen to my record before it comes out. That's the first thing. Because it's before the judgment calls have come. And I tell you, I enjoy listening to this record so much. And probably because of being away from being a solo artist for a little bit, I think that had something to do with it. But I really like it a lot.
And it feels like, ooh, ba-da-da-da-da-da. Do you remember the last time we shared a laugh? It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever see a smile. I've never been the fool to think that love don't cost a little pain. I don't think it's supposed to be this hard to get along.
It Ain't Supposed to Be This Way is the song that is the one you hear when you click on your website. Is that because that's the one you guys want to push?
I felt like it was a good balance of the R&B and the jazz connection between both sides. Because I think if we went with First Kiss, which I absolutely love too, it would have lended more to the jazz side of the album. And the R&B crowd might not have come to it with the awareness that it's more R&B stuff on there also.
It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever feel your touch. I've never been a fool to think love don't cost a little pain.
But I don't think it's supposed to be. Your voice has been compared to a number of others because of your multiple octave range. Mm-hmm. Minnie Riperton for one, Niecy Williams for another, mm-hmm. and I know that you've done covers of both of their songs, but there is another sound that you have that I actually didn't know you had. Nancy Wilson. Guess who I saw today, my dear.
Guess who I saw today, my dear.
It was a challenge because it's Nancy, but because of what it means to do a Nancy Wilson song.
Yeah. Pressure.
Yeah, that's pressure. And actually, I had the best compliment. She heard the song, and she came to me and told me how much she really, really liked it. And she was just smiling. She was like, I mean, you nailed it, baby.
Don't say a word. Don't say a word. Boy, don't try denying what fate has shown me to.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Shantae Moore a little more personally, if that's okay with you. Because I read a quote of yours, and I want to read it to you and see what you see what you meant by it.
Okay.
Here it is. I think that's what I was put here to do, talk about my own life and my own views. I like to be able to expose my experiences so that people know they are not alone.
Yes.
Do you remember saying that?
Absolutely.
What do you mean?
Well, I've been through a lot. People don't like talking about things that hurt. Usually we like to skip over that stuff because it brings up something that's unpleasant. But honestly, it's the only way that I feel like some of those things have purpose because of somebody else's journey. And I really believe, you know, the quote from the scriptures that says, all things work together for my good. All things work together for my good, not just the stuff I liked, not just the stuff that felt really great and the highs in my life that were wonderful. Even not selling records has worked for my good because my ego is not in a place where you can't be in the same room with me and fit. I'm not in the place that when I see an unwed mother at 17 that I go, she probably didn't have no mama that cared about her. I had a mama that cared and I could have been that girl. And because of knowing that it could have been me, when I see them, the empathy in my heart is different than somebody else's who doesn't know what it's like to be that girl who's been manipulated and her innocence stolen from her. It was stolen from me. And I know what that feels like. And you feel by yourself. You feel damaged goods.
Your innocence was stolen from you?
Stolen. Yeah. And it happens to so many women, black, white, yellow, orange, green, whatever it is. We've all been in places where we've been victimized in some kind of way, usually.
Out of respect, I don't want to go there. Out of curiosity, I do. how much are you willing to tell us about how your innocence was stolen from you?
Well, growing up in a Christian family, you would have thought what happened to me would never happen because my mother loved me and she was very much aware of who I am. But I was a very mature little girl. And at 14, I was allowed to have a crush on a man who was 21. And because he was worldly and had money and he'd been in the Navy, you know, and I was like all little girls see older men and we go, oh, my God, he's so cute. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, somehow in there, my father wasn't watching. My mother was watching very closely and thought she could handle the situation. And she allowed this relationship to happen. It should not have happened. I should not have been allowed to date a man. It made me have insecurities at an early age that I should never have had. But a man who could manipulate a little girl's mind and her heart, he was allowed to do things he shouldn't have done.
You have daughters?
I have one daughter.
That will not happen to her.
She will not be allowed to do that. She can have the crush because you can't stop a heart from beating. You can't stop them from going, oh, my God, I love him. That's beautiful. But no man's going to walk up in my house and steal my baby. It's not going to happen.
Let me ask you one other thing about you. And I appreciate the time and I appreciate your sharing that story with us. But, you know, everyone in life has career choices.
That was NPR's Tony Cox talking to singer Shantae Moore.